This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Friday Training on Thursday, and I have a special lesson today, life lessons that are derived from golf. And who better to help me describe the lessons that we can learn on the course to utilize with our life than the expert at that, the man who helps not only the greatest golfers that play the game perform at their highest level, but also executives and other coaches, speakers, the incredible Virgil Herring. You could check him out on Golf Channel. You can see him all over the place. But I had to have this training, Virgil, with you because my son started playing golf about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, because I stopped playing because of the time. And the only reason I started playing again is I want to spend time with my son. I played since I've been 10, never had a lesson. And I enjoy the mindset side of golf more than anything. And it's so much fun to teach my son about life while he's playing golf. Unfortunately, I don't have the capability you have, which is to teach both how to achieve whatever we want in life, but also to be better golfer, which so many people utilize in business as well. So I want to, number one, thank you for joining me, and this is going to be a lot of fun. We'll start, you and I will just have a conversation, and then we'll take questions from everyone. Hopefully you'll think of something that's relative or resonates with you. Even if you don't play golf, there's these lessons that I carry over in my life. So the first thing I want to start with is a lot of people don't understand how much golf is in the mind. And when I listen to your podcast, watch your content, get to talk to the people that you've helped perform better, they all tell me, look, almost anyone can teach you a good swing, even though you're known as the swing guru. But it's really Virgil's expertise is between the ears. How much of golf is mental?
Well, at every talent level, it's, if everybody's a 10 handicap, the person with the best mind will win. On the TV level, everybody's equal talented. They're all superstars. Who wins? The person who has the best mindset. Because this week's the perfect example. We've got the US Open. It's the hardest test in golf anywhere at any time. And you're going to face adversity that you can't even prepare for. And then, like, herein lies one of my biggest questions that I always trying to encourage people to figure out is what makes golf and life so challenging is you prepare intently to be awesome at something at the highest level at the biggest moment. And what if it doesn't work out? It's one of the hardest things for people to overcome, which is dream, prepare, game plan, execute, fail. And more times than not in golf, there's 156 people playing this week at the US Open, and there's going to be 155 losers, and one person will win. And the mindset that it requires to have over and over again, over 72 holes of hitting, doing your very best at the right shot and hitting a pretty good shot that gets penalized is eerily similar to the things that we do in our life, in which we prepare to do the best for our family, for our company, for whatever it is that we're doing. And when our best doesn't work out, the attitude in which you take in the struggle of it not working out is what separates elite from good and good from average and average from poor. My job is to figure out where you are in that spectrum and head up the elite pile as fast as we possibly can, because we know what it takes to be great, but we don't know how to overcome the pain and the adversity of our best effort not being good enough. And that is one of the biggest challenges we face.
And I can see that within the context of the US Open and people who are elite. But a lot of people struggle before they get there. They struggle with the dream aspect and the preparation aspect. And they are, like you said, not quite on that spectrum mm-hmm. of elite where it's a matter of strictly mindset. One of the things that I try to help people with is a commitment to consistent behavior. And one of the lessons that I love about golf is that at an amateur level, a corporate real estate executive that likes to play three times a week, that those that are committed to consistent behavior, whether it's swinging the same way, going to the range, whatever it is, they get exponential results. What have you learned in your career about that commitment part to the consistent behavior, not just consistent behavior of practicing?
Well, at the end of the day, I think we're always searching for the process that allows us to constantly be 1% better than we were yesterday. That's the big challenge, right? So finding the right process. So those people that you're talking about, they have a successful process that they've streamlined that allows them to find 1% better each day. To me, I believe that we go from hope to believe to know. When you get hope, you find something that you love to do, that you get introduced to something. Wow, I love this. This is kind of fun. That's the, I hope I can do this. And then you learn how to do something until you can do it right. Now you believe you can do it. And there are sometimes you can perform greatness from a belief state. But when you move to the place where you know you can, that means you've done it until you can't do it wrong. So consistency is the every day doing the exact same thing on the process that you're believing in that's going to take you there until you can't do it wrong. And when you can't do it wrong, you know you can perform.
And when we do it right, one of the other aspects of golf, which is totally applicable to life, is that, you know, I love playing with my son, and he'll hit a perfect drive. For his 14 years old, he'll draw the ball right down the middle of the hole, and it'll go farther than he even thought because it was a perfect drive, and it'll catch a slope and it'll roll right into a sand trap, and he's pissed. And he can't see that he's done everything right because he's so attached to the outcome that it either rolled in a sand trap or went too far and rolled into the lake. There's a million different scenarios on a golf course where perfect shots aren't perfect outcomes. And I see that with entrepreneurship, that as I coach entrepreneurs, they're making perfect shots, but they're so attached to the outcome that they're like, yeah, but our sales are here, or that person said no, or I haven't raised the money that I needed. They're so attached to the outcome. How do you help people detach from the outcome and understand process, but also understanding a difference between doing what is necessary in the long run compared to a short-term outcome?
Well, that's ultimately this trick that in America, if you're not first, you seem to be the worst. And it just creates this mindset that if I've played my best and I didn't win, I suck.
Right.
And that's no good. But it's cultivated in media, what we listen to, what we read, it's everywhere we go. So you have to, my job is to interview the people and figure out where are we really? And then from there, it's like, how can I get you to understand what have you come here for? I've come here to become, I want to get a college scholarship. I'm 15 years old, I want to play golf in college. Where are we now? And then we're going to build this and just know that if it took experience to win, nobody would have ever won, right? The visualization of greatness is every bit as important as being great. So the visualization, what do you want? Paint the picture as vividly as you can in your mind of what you want the outcome to be. Then build a process around that. And one day is not the end destination. It's a long journey that we're on. And along the way, we may not receive many trophies. But if we keep improving, one of my favorite lines from Dr. Rotella is, if you follow the process of greatness, I can guarantee you, you will achieve it. The problem is I can't tell you when. And the lack of patience and the lack of trust that you are good enough to outlast that moment is really the separator between people that make it and the people that don't, is that they don't know that they can make it one more day. And that is my job, is to keep encouraging. And if I study my sport well enough, I can tell them stories about Tiger Woods failing many times more than he succeeded, but he's still considered the greatest we've ever seen. Keep in mind that the greatest we've ever seen has only won 24% of the times that he's competed, but most people think it's way higher than that. Mm-hmm. And if I can continue to encourage them that if you listen to Tiger and all the processes that he has constantly refined, he's the greatest ever, and he still only succeeded 24% of the time. So that means if you're not Tiger, your number might be 4 or 5%. But that doesn't mean you don't find little pearls of joy in the 1% every day, because that's the grind that what it takes to be great.
And in that grind, in that perspective of joy, my definition of happiness is to enjoy the consistent, everyday, persistent without quit pursuit of your own potential. There's a saying with quarterbacks is their skills and their knowledge are the basement. The desire determines their potential. And I've always focused my life in what I enjoy doing. So football, for example, my basement's very low. I joke around that I could live to my potential in football and it'll still be far below most Division I college players, let alone pro players' basement. Or LeBron James in basketball. I promise you I could spend my lifetime enjoying the consistent, persistent pursuit of my potential as a basketball player, and I won't reach the basement of most people. Mm-hmm. But yet in golf, it holds true as well, but it seems to be more difficult to enjoy it. Coming from someone who enjoyed playing football, there's a different level, but there's something segmented in golf that makes it really hard, especially when you first start, mm-hmm. to enjoy the consistent, persistent pursuit of your potential. What do you think it is that differentiates golf itself? Because I think life is more like golf, mm-hmm. in its specific aspect of, it's so difficult to enjoy, especially at the beginning, business or family or marriage, or it's just the beginning's tough.
Yeah, that's very true. The learning curve in golf is radically steep. And then once you kind of get it, it really levels off, and then you can find that 1% plateau. The real reason it's difficult is because it's the only target-oriented sport in the world, played standing to the side, and you're bent over. So it is muscularly very challenging. Okay, so that's one part that's difficult. It's an open-air, target-oriented sport. So that means we got variables of wind, temperature. The variable list is massive.
Moisture.
I mean, there's so many things that impact how the ball flies past your effort. Much like life, though, there are many things that you're going to face that you did all the right things and it didn't work out. And when you learn that day one with a golf club in your hand, it's different than the buzz you get when you fall in love for the first time. The first couple months are so easy because it's so great. You don't get that in golf. The first time you fall in love with the game, you've taken three punches to the face. And you're like, what did I sign up for this? But the challenge, what's interesting is like accomplishment comes from overcoming adversity and challenges. There's nothing easy about golf, but when you conquer it, even for a hole, the level of joy that you receive from tackling something so challenging and coming out winning at that moment is an addictive substance, because once you feel like you've accomplished it once, now you're going to try to do it two times in a day. Then you're going to try to do it three times a day. Then you're going, can I just get 9 good holes in a row one day? And as soon as you start to stack success, and that's my job, is to remind you of how you're stacking success, even though sometimes it looks like failure, to be able to remind you how well you're doing compared to where you were, and look how you're moving upward with the process being, you're just doing the same things over and over and over again. That's where it gets really fun, but you don't get any immediacy. It's a long-standing chase or journey through life with it than it is the immediate buzz of, you know, falling in love with something like another person.
And understanding that segmentation and separation that exists in golf emotionally. One of the things I see playing with my own son is that We could be on a par five and I screw up my drive, but I hit it 150 yard drive, but it's in the fairway. Yeah. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, I took my third shot. Right. Oh, I took my third shot first.
What an awesome attitude.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of my attitude in business and life, is that I take the circumstances that exist right now and put it back into the divine direction of what I want to be in. And yet most new players, I'm not picking on my son, but cannot see that at all. Right. If they want to get there in two, because lo and behold, he hits the ball far enough that every once in a while he does get there in two. And that now becomes the reality, where my reality is, I know if I get there in three, I got a chance for birdie because I practice putting a lot.
Well, another thing I think is interesting is that golf is viewed first, usually, by the very greatest in the world. Like football, most people watch football when they're watching little 9 and 10 year olds play. Watching basketball, they're watching 7 and 8 year olds kind of just learn how to. So they don't see Michael Jordan first. They're watching their brother or sister or watching some friends play, and they see failure. But there's no, you're not, nobody's just going out to Arroyo to just watch people that they don't even know shoot 97.
Soccer,
right? So the perception is, well, Tiger shot 63 and won by 10. That looks easy. That's most people's first dose of golf, is they watch it on television, because it's not a spectator sport, essentially. Right. So the perception that your son has is, when I watch golf, I'm watching Rory and Jordan Spieth and Scottie Scheffler and Tiger Woods, and they just do it. Why can't I do it? My swing looks good. I've worked really hard at it, except that Tiger's worked at it longer than you've been alive times three. But that doesn't resonate with him, because he's like, I can already do it, so why can't I do it? And that is what really painful to the psyche, is that you cannot believe that your best effort wasn't good enough.
It's interesting, because there's another aspect of video games. So, you know, I know Warren Moon, the Hall of Fame quarterback, and I spent an inordinate amount of time together, and I could not teach football to my son when he's four, because the rules are complex. And so I asked him, I said, well, what can you teach him, bro? Like, you're a Hall of Famer. He's like, no, I can't. He said, but what I can do is give you this Madden game, and it'll teach him the rules of football. It'll teach him the game of football. And yet he saw different players of different sizes, and I don't think he had a personal feeling that, because he could throw like Warren Moon on the game, that's how it goes. But in golf, and I watched the Tiger Woods game, right, once again, is reinforcing that same thing. Yeah. That, oh, my swing, and here's this. It's a different feel. How much impact does video games have on younger golfers of what's possible at the beginning when they first start?
Wow, I have not really had many players that were kind of drawn to the game through video games. But I will say that when I was in college, that visual was a major player in people thinking that they were going to be better than they really were, because they could do it on a video game, and they felt like they visualized what they wanted it to do on the video. They knew how to make the buttons work, which is kind of like making the buttons work in your golf swing. Why can I not do it in real person, in real life? Because it's got to be much harder to do with a paddle or something than it is to do it with myself. But it's not the same thing. And if you don't understand the complexities of golf, like truly what it takes to be good at it, most of you probably wouldn't even start if they knew how difficult it was, because it just doesn't look 1/100th as difficult as it really is. But that then becomes the addiction. It's like the difference between checkers and chess. Once you figure out checkers, but chess has endless amounts of possibilities. Golf has endless amounts of possibilities, and it never gets boring. And I think that's where there are certain people that cannot gravitate to it. But most people, once they have any kind of success at it, they chase it because it's difficult.
One of the things we share in a philosophy in life and golf, which I found really interesting, is the major shift in my paradigm in life was, I am blank. What am I doing to interfere with it? I am happy. What am I doing to interfere with it? I'm healthy. What am I doing to interfere with it? I'm wealthy. What am I doing to interfere with it? And it's an abundant philosophy of ascertaining a pathway to what already exists. Mm. And I've heard you articulate on multiple occasions this idea and the mindset of golf. It's my job is to figure out what you're doing to interfere with your potential, your authentic swing, as they said in one of my favorite movies, Bagger Vance, which has so many great lessons. After I'm done teaching life lessons through the movie The Miracle on Ice, I'm going to use that Bagger Vance as my next movie to critique. Yeah. What does that mean to you in golf, saying, well, what are you doing to interfere with it? Should be the perspective and the paradigm shift instead of somehow you're in control.
Well, this is a multi-layered answer, right? So a lot of interference first comes from somebody that loves that person, judges them on their failure. So now they're a failure, and now they have to go back and get better. And then they go back out and try to compete 5 days later in another event. And now the fear of being ridiculed by somebody that says they love them is really challenging. So that's probably the most common problem I have, is either a parent or a loved one is a hard driver, and that parent most of the time isn't very good either. And when they fail, they shame them. And the shame that a kid feels by letting their parent down or letting a loved one down is massive. And then when they go back out, and as they get better and they play in bigger events, all the bigger event means is bigger criticism. So I have to come in, and I end up having to coach parents a lot, and have the, like, I have to say, sometimes you have to understand, child, that your parents love you so much, they're trying to prevent you from pain. And what you hear when mom and dad are telling you this is that you don't think I'm trying. So mom, you need to understand, like, when you come down on your son or daughter, you're trying to impart your years of wisdom on what's going on and how to overcome it. And all your kid hears is, you don't think I'm trying. So they feel deflated by getting in the game, because they're afraid to make a mistake in a game that is literally riddled with mistakes. Riddled with mistakes. That's one of them. Another one is when you've worked really, really, really hard to do something and you fail at that. Now you start to think that, well, I can't prepare any better than I did. I can't work any harder than I did. And I didn't come out on top. Maybe I'm not good. And that's really hard. Man, just like 2 hours ago, my son's playing in a big golf tournament. I get a text message from my son. I'm the worst golfer in the world. So that was literally 5 seconds after we heard how important your self-talk is. Yeah. And I'm like, why wasn't I recording that? But it's so fascinating. The interference is fear. The prefrontal cortex, when it's engaged in an active motion, slows down the transmission from muscle memory, from the part of the brain that stores what you've done over your lifetime. It parses it because it's trying to perfect it, because the fear of failure has overcome the desire to succeed. So as soon as the prefrontal cortex tries to perfect all the positions of the golf swing, it slows it down into its clunkiest form. So my job is to figure out a way, and this is all I study now, how do I get you into a place where your prefrontal cortex is off, the right side of your brain is on, and now you have access to all of your talent? That is what I study. I study how to get underneath the hood. So neuro-linguistic programming. I talk to you in a way that draws you in. Now you're present because you're listening, because I'm doing something with my voice that is different. So you're like, you have to lean in. Like, what's going on? Now, once I get you present, you're no longer in the past with your failure. You're no longer in the front with the fear of failure and the anxiety of failing again. Now you're here, right where your feet are. Now that I got you here, what are we doing right now? Right now, I have to hit a tee shot. What do we have to do to hit a good tee shot on this hole? I want to hit it here. And like, vivid, paint the most beautiful picture you can right now. And the more vivid they get, the more present they get, and the more that right side has got the paintbrush, it takes control, and that part of the brain guides the muscles into doing what we want it to do. And that is the art of what I do. That is the only reason why I'm still doing it, because understanding the golf swing is machine, precision, boring, because that doesn't work. Choking, nervous, fearing of failing, worrying about what tomorrow brings, worrying about what yesterday brought, all of those things interfere with what you know right now. And none of it has anything to do with right now, unless you let it. And many people let the past or the future interfere with the now. And my job is to bring the now into the most important thing we have. And that is business, life, and sport.
Last point, though, we'll take some questions. Big moments. There's a fallacy that certain people perform better under pressure, that they perform better in big moments. Statistically, many of us don't know this, but whether it's Michael Jordan, LeBron James, whether it's the best golfers in the world, the actual numbers of performance go down for everyone. And there's anomalies, the Gene Tennises of the world or the Jim Leyritz, the one-hit wonders that, you know, get one chance to step up in a big moment and hit a home run. But that's not the true statistics of people in big moments. People in big moments don't perform as well. And that's across the board in all sports. What, though, is the difference between those that are closer to their normal performance in big moments, which statistically will create big moments and big names? So where in big moments, what comes out and how do we stay more consistent in big moments than even trying to be better in big moments, which is an impossibility?
This is interesting. So, right, true, the greatest moments of our life occur when we are in a situation that is somewhere between 1% and 20% past our average best of our time. Like, so when that one person had no expectation, like Jim Leyritz, right? Yeah. Had no expectation he was going to be a hero. He's just trying to just get a hit. So he's immediately present, and he knows that this is a moment, and the only chance I have is to be here right now. I'm not one of the greatest players with all the pressure. I have no pressure. Nobody expects me to do anything. Expectations are a cancer. So because those one-hit wonders, they have no expectations, they're able to be free. By definition, choking occurs when you're in a situation that is more than 20% past your best. But if you're only 5% past your best, and you're really locked in because you know that you're this is big and you have to be present, that's where we get it. But as soon as Jim Leyritz has that one home run, how did he do after that? Because once it was now expected of him, he's a clutch player. Look what he did last year. Now the expectation's hitting, and now he was stuck in a past moment and in a future moment. And he was no longer present when he hit the home run that was so impactful to his career. That is really the biggest thing we face, is where are we in that moment so that we've prepared ourselves for something, knowing that our greatest outcome that we ever pour out of ourselves will not be that limit that we showed before, but we push ourselves to a place that we've never been before, but not too far past. But that one tick higher allows us to immediately focus in on being present, because that's our only chance. And that's when we play our greatest moment, which is why I'm really, like Eckhart Tolle says, immersive presence is required for zone state or flow state. Anything else other than that, you have to be thinking. One of my favorite lines is, if you're in the zone, you're not thinking. But if you're not in the zone, you better be thinking. Because and that is the dance that we have is, if you're not in the zone, you have to think strategically to make the game easy. All of a sudden you can become present. And if not, you're in your own head, you're interfering with yourself. And I call that job security.
Yeah, for you. my job security is mommy issues. So I got a ton of people with mommy issues. Almost everyone is my potential client. So I want to be an expert on mommy issues. It's interesting. We're going to take some questions now. There was a moment in golf, in my daughter, I wanted her to play golf because it's the easiest scholarship to get. It was selfish. And then I decided with my son, I wouldn't force him to play, cause I learned my lessons. But I think it was the British Open, and Tom Watson was over 50 years old, and he was going to be the oldest person to win the British Open. And Tom Watson is known to be one of the best putters, in golf, and even at that time. And putting is something that doesn't diminish as you get older, unless you get really old. But at 50, you're most likely a better putter than you were when you were 30, from statistics. And he had a very short putt to win the British Open. And I called over my daughter saying, "This is amazing. Like, you're going to see something. This guy's the best putter in the world. He has like a 2.5-foot putt. He's going to win the British Open, and he's 54 years old or whatever he was." And he pushed it. And I could feel the expectation in being in sports so long. So many people call it a jinx when they're like, "Well, he can't miss. He's the best free throw shooter of all time," or "He's kicked 13 field goals in a row." People feel like that's the curse. But now I understand the curse is that when the expectations are elevated by an announcer, he's just signifying that the expectations are probably in the mind of the performer as well, which is why statistically you see that as a jinx. By the way, Clinton, who's in the other room, he told me I jinxed him playing craps because I said something. So my expectation that he was a winner, he got pissed at me because he choked and he sevened out and lost all my money. But anyways, we're not going to get into gambling yet, but you're welcome to ask about it. Incredible life lessons you can see applicable to business and your personal life that come from golf, which is why a lot of people enjoy it so much. And I do suggest you watch the movie Bagger Vance as well as follow Virgil. I'm curious what questions now have arise. Colleen.
There's so much talk about consistency, just, you know, creating those good habits, what we do, and finding kind of that magic within the mundane. What's an example of a routine you would give one of your golfers to create good habits?
Because one of my favorite things to talk about is, like, if you went to your college class history and the very first day you sit down, the professor says 44% of the final is going to be on why Hitler invaded Poland and all the things that happened during that. Do you think that you're going to study Hitler invading Poland? Heck yeah, you are. I'm here to tell you that putting is 44% of the game, no matter if you shoot 61 or 161. How many people practice putting 44% of the time? That would be zero, right? So my job is to bring analytics in to the process. If 44% of the game is putting and we have 2 hours to work on our game, we're going to be practicing about 50 minutes on that part of the game because it deserves that much time. So I'm setting up. I know that 83% of the game, no matter how good you are, occurs with a driver, a sand wedge, or a lob wedge, and your putter. So driver, wedge, putter is 83% of the game. The other 11 clubs that you're allowed to have in your bag consist of the other 17%. So don't really spend a whole lot of time on the 1.7% per club when 44% of the game is putting, 25% of the game is with your wedges and short game, and you're going to hit 14 drivers. So there is, we build our practice out of what is required. But literally most people go into the pro shop, buy a large basket of balls, go out on the driving range, and really, they think they're practicing. Where all they're really doing is exercising.
They're having fun. Because they enjoy different clubs.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
They're having fun.
Yeah, so like that's how I'm building it around fat. Because it, when you start to get into the weeds, you fall in line with following some myths, some incorrect information, what somebody else said. When the statistics clearly show, boom, 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 I'm here to make it real for you so that anytime you're struggling, you can look to reality instead of, well, this person said this. And that's one of the biggest, that's one of the biggest challenges I have is other people's opinion.
Yeah, and all of us in that gap of I am compared to what I want people to think I am. Just to put that into context in business, getting people to call you back, for example, that's like putting. And sleep is another one that's like putting. You know, very few people focus in on their sleep, but they spend a third of their life sleeping. And they're not intentional about sleep. They go to sleep at night, wake up more tired in the morning than when they went to bed, which makes absolutely no sense to me at all. And getting people to call you back, statistically in business, especially because of the access that we have to a huge total addressable community, getting people to call you back is the easiest and fastest way to be statistical success in what you do. If you can reach 1,000 people in a minute, 1,000 people in an hour, 1,000 people in a day, which everybody can do, and you can get twice as many people to get back to you, without getting any better at what you do, you'll have twice as many sales. Without getting any better, but because more people are calling you back, you'll actually get better because you'll be practicing as well. So I'm sure the same exponentiality holds true in golf as well. So as you carry these lessons over from golf, of understanding the statistics in practicing what's most important, you know, for me, practicing sleep is most important of anything at all. It's just like putting, except for it's, you know, literally 33% of your life. And there's way more clubs in your bag of what you're doing. There's nothing else in your life that you will do 33% of the time every single day. I guarantee it. Nothing else that you can practice. So why don't we practice sleep? And then in sales, the majority of the time is reaching out to get people to call us back. Especially today via email, social media, in person, on the phone, whatever it may be. Practice getting people to call you back and you'll have the fastest track to success. All right, great questions. Justin.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm hoping you both speak to both sides of it. Is that golf is a game of misses. I think I heard someone say once they hit pros, maybe hit like 3 to 4 shots around that are perfect at what they wanted to do. So I'm curious, Bridge, like how you prepare your students and your golfers to manage the misses. One of the best advice I think was like Dr. Brett McCabe or something. He said, like, you're going to make bogeys, just don't make doubles. And I've tried to adapt that to my own life. It's like, in everything you do in life, like, you're going to screw up, you're going to get into bad situations, but don't compound it and make a double. Yeah. Obviously, you still all do. But I'm hoping you speak to, like, how do you prepare people to not make doubles? And then, Dave, you could talk about the business world of, like, more things are going to go wrong than go right of what we exactly plan. And so how do you, on the mindset side of business, you know, trying your best to not make doubles?
Yeah, so first thing, you can't prepare for a bad golf shot, right? So that throw out like the unprescribed terrible golf shot. You can't prepare for that. Once again, it falls into analytics for me. I know that shot dispersions, how far they're going to be offline. For a right-handed golfer, their long shots go left, their short shots go right. That creates a shot pattern that looks oblong, like an oval, that's long left, short right. Now, where are the bunkers? Where's the water? Where's the out of bounds? Now you have to make sure that that shot pattern, all of those balls, if you get 100 shots, how do I get 100 shots and not be penalized, get the most in the fairway or on the green that I can, and then when you're doing the math, all this is just math. I mathematically disassemble a golf course for my players so that they strategically place their shot pattern in safe places, and the best players have the smallest patterns. And then have the discipline to aim the shot pattern perfectly, not being tempted by how good they are. And maybe this time I'm going to be the one, I'm going to aim at the flag, even though I shouldn't. Those people who have the discipline to follow what is right all the time are the ones that are spectacularly celebrated, even though sometimes they don't do anything spectacular. Scotty Scheffler, right? So like, to me, like that's how I go about doing it, is that I create evidence that gives us strategy based around analytics that are clearly proven, and then we just drill it until it becomes the only thing you know how to do.
Yeah, and for me, complementary to that is the values that I have. And I think that just like everything, music is made by the spaces in between the notes. It's the space that you can't see. So one, utilizing gratitude, defying the light, the love, and the lesson in the miss. And I think that's applicable in golf, you know, to learn from, not get upset about the bad shots or picking up your head or whatever it is. You know, some of the greatest rounds of golf have had bogeys and double bogeys in history, mm-hmm. from the greatest players. It's because they found the light, the love, and the lesson in the double bogey, and were then able to forgive themselves, to put themselves back at ease instead of beating themselves up about the miss. And so remember, our subconscious mind, 80% of the thoughts that are regenerated every single day and repetitive from the 40,000 thoughts that exist in the subconscious mind, whether it's for golf, your family life, or your business, are negative. You've inherited those. You've inherited genetically, energetically, and experientially. And so if you don't utilize a counteractive behavior with gratitude and forgiveness, you're just going to perpetuate going to where you don't want to be or what other people think. So when your friends say something like, oh, you're just this person's bitch or something like that, you can go ahead and dive right down into that road, or you can use gratitude and forgiveness to be accountable and tell yourself, what did I do to be responsible for this? What did I do to attract this? And how am I participating in the perception, which is something that Virgil's an expert at, teaching people that participation in the perception. And most importantly, through accountability, using gratitude and forgiveness, it's what am I learning constantly so my next shot's better, and so that I end up being in the place that I want to be or better. And I don't destroy a round or a tournament because of one bad shot and not using those tools, or I don't destroy my whole business over one bad decision, or my marriage over one bad activity or action. These are what people do all day long. They double down on dumb shit because they're looking at misses. Bye, Clinton. Let me have fun at Legoland.
Thank you.
I will come give me a hug. Everyone, bye. This is called a Clinton Sparks break for our Thursday, Friday trading. Incredible Clinton Sparks. 80 million records sold. Just won an award with Lady Gaga. He stole my sweater. He's supposed to wear a shirt underneath it. But if I had pills of thrills like that, that's so good.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, love you, Clinton. Thank you for showing up. Get familiar, stay familiar, be familiar, Clinton Sparks. And then the last part, Justin, about misses, is that in the context of interfering, we have gratitude, forgiveness, and accountability, but it's how much time are you spending in spirit, the zone, right? Because he says the only time you think is what? When you're not in the zone. That's when you should be thinking. Otherwise, you're at ease and you already are utilizing a gateway, a pathway, and ascertaining information of perfection from a perfect source. And the more you diminish the capacity of interference, we're more inspired in spirit than less inspired. And no better game to learn about misses than, you know, 18 holes of golf with somewhere between, depending how good you are, 59 and 159 shots.
Exactly right. Forgiveness is a really big part for sure, because everybody's desire to be perfect is ultimately the problem. Chase the best that you can be is very different than chasing perfection. No, that doesn't mean you don't try to be as close to perfect as you can be, but there's a big difference between the best that you can be and perfect. Sometimes can be very far apart, but if you're the best that you can be, what more could you ask of yourself?
And that's where, for me, the common denominator of success and successful people. I mean, think about who's here today. Virgil, Rene Rodriguez, Clinton Sparks, Bruce Tolner, Bruce Kirk, Danius, is like every one of these people have one thing in common and they do totally different stuff. They just have a desire that they must be what they can be. They don't have desire to be the best. That's different. Now you're attached to an outcome, something that you can't control when you try to be the best at something. I can't control how good you are. I can't, but I can be and have a desire to be my best. And that may be far below your best, and that's okay. And I think that's a big distinction. It's why, as I got older, I learned to play the white tees. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is behind me on the blues and the blacks. And yes, they laugh at me, make fun of me, and scoff at me. But I know that the minute I step back to the blues, I try too hard. I'm very comfortable knowing I'll have plenty of distance at the white. And the irony is, I guarantee my average drive from the white tees, which is closer than the blue and the black tees, my average drive from the white tees is 20 yards longer than when I move back to the blue tees, on average. Yeah. It's because I'm at ease. And it's really good. All right, next question.
I wanted to ask you, what are you doing to keep yourself accountable when you have that day or some sort of struggles and obstacles?
You don't have any struggles, do you?
Man, that is outstanding. What do I do to hold myself accountable? Well, one, I'm a role model to two sons. And they need to know that what they see their dad get a chance to do, it looks like everything's easy, but they've been shielded and protected from some of the most incredible adversity that I could ever dream up. And it's happened to me. Right. So I have to be able to demonstrate poise, character, honesty, integrity, and all of the things that you'd want to be, because I got two people that call me their hero. And every day that I live, I know that something could happen that could change that if I don't do what I'm supposed to do. And I know that there's going to be, I've had plenty of terrible things happen with my best intentions lined up for it. Mm-hmm. That's how I live my life, is that I can't believe that even right now I have an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I am their hero. And I'm supposed to be laughed at and made fun of now because they're that old, but they literally hang on everything that I say. And I know that that may not always be the case, but every day I live my life as if that will always be the case. And knowing that is what keeps me going, because that's what my dad did for me. And that's probably bigger than whatever I become, is the fact that I try to demonstrate what I think it's going to take for them to face their own life adversity. And when it does happen to them, when they get older, that makes the stories that I've shielded them from having to understand, they will then understand those days that dad didn't seem right. He seemed like something was bothering him, something was, and then they're like, so that's how you conduct yourself when things are falling apart? Yes.
So you show them something.
Yes, which is key to anyone of holding yourself accountable, because no matter who they are, your kids, your employees, your associates, your friends, they actually don't listen to you. And Renee told you why bioanatomically and chemically people don't listen to you, because of the empty space that you're filling with perception. But everybody watches you. And you know, for me, my mission of what I want for my kids, for example, is I just want them to do their best at whatever they want to do. I want them to learn every time they're doing something, and I want them to enjoy doing it regardless of the misses. I dream of the day when I'm playing golf with my 14-year-old son and he can hit a ball into the water and be at the same level of emotion as when he first walked up to the ball. With great expectation. That is a gift. Or even to the point where I've seen progress of him getting back to center, where I can see how quickly he's compared to when we started, gets back to center when he hits a bad shot, because he's learning to do his best. He's learning to learn lessons from the misses and still have fun. And if you're not doing that, then they're not going to do it. You could tell them all day long, don't drink, don't drive, don't do this, don't whatever it is. But if you're not walking the walk and they're watching you, it doesn't mean, excuse my language, it won't mean dick. And I see a lot of parents, you know, do as I say, not as I do. That doesn't work in life. I want my kids to do as I do. And I'm old enough now where I'm very, very confident and accountable that I'm okay if my kids do what I do, I'm okay with it. When I was 35, I would not be okay with it. And, you know, luckily Marissa didn't watch me or listen to me, so she's okay. Cool. All right, Max, next question. Oh, Philip.
So I actually
right microphone coach, master, so super rhyme maker.
I coach too.
Last question. Okay.
That's by like my famous Trevor Moat, right? Trying to just keep him.
Who I went to college with, one of my best friends who passed away. Shout out.
Yeah, he's a legend. But staying neutral, how do you not get up? But you know, but the kids, I don't really do much. They're like already pretty good. So getting them out of their head and just staying connected to the target or whatever. What are some cues that maybe who had no idea of golf swings or patterns? What are some cues that you use that are really simple, that boil it down as simple as possible and make it go, oh, let's see, that's way easier than what I was thinking or what I was feeling?
As in a swing?
Yeah, as in actually playing the game.
Oh, an actual golf question. Awesome. Okay.
But sort of how could it translate to someone who doesn't understand?
He's a scratch golfer, so this is good.
Doesn't understand golf could go, oh, that makes it way more simple. God. Swing planes and so you know wind and all these things. How can you simplify it?
Okay, that's a great question, and I've never really thought of it in this terms like you just put it. Okay, aim. In our life, we're aiming at something, right? So when we're playing golf, the hardest part of the game is aim, because golf is the only target-oriented sport. Play standing to the side, so it'd be like giving you a rifle in a field full of deer where you got to shoot the gun like this. You might be standing there for a while until you hit something, right? So that's hard. Then, like, what has to happen is you have to be in a posture, balanced position so that you can turn as much as you can on the way back without losing balance, and then swing as fast as you can to a balance, another key word, balance in your life, so that your centers face where you're aimed. If you can do that, that's all that's required to play fun golf. If you can do that, that's all you need to be functionally good at life. Mm-hmm. What's your aim? Can you build a posture and a body language that allows you to load up and unload your gifts at your aim? If you can do that, you're successful. And that doesn't mean you're the greatest in the world, but you're the greatest that you can be. And that's why we're here, to figure out how great you can be.
That's great.
And the way I put that into context is the same thing in business and life. Know your what is your aim. What do I want today in a divine direction of where I think I want to be? Know your who you can help and who can help you. Know your how, prioritize it, and then apply your why. And all of those can be relative to that aim, balance, and execute, is knowing your what, your who, your how, and your now, and applying your why. And you'll just get to where you want to be or better faster than you think, aggregating all the things necessary to get there and creating exponentiality of outcomes, a greater exponential success. You'll get better in a different way. 1 × 2 × 4 × 8 × 16, not 1 + 2 + 3, 4, 5, 6. So we are blessed to have the best here at the PGA Mastermind, the incredible Virgil Herring. Let's give him a big round of applause. Whether it's golf or business or life or family or friends or fitness or faith or finance, there's lessons that are applicable to them all. Use gratitude, empathy, accountability, and effective communication in order to get the most out of your own life. Enjoy the consistent, persistent pursuit of your own potential. There's great lessons. Go back and watch it. We'll provide you the exercise and guide. You can reach out to Virgil. Where can people see you?
My Instagram is virgil.herring. You can look me up on virgilherring.com. And my cell phone is 615-579-5190.
There you go. Email me, david@dmeltzer.com. We're going to be all over the place. We did our Friday training on Thursday for that reason. I'll be in Chicago this weekend, then Toronto, then back to LA, then Las Vegas, then New York, and then back to Orange County. 200 cities booked this year. Come and join us. Don't forget July 19th. A lot of these people that are here today with me will be at YouTube Theater. I'm collaborating with Dane Cook. We're going to laugh louder and think bigger with people like Rob Riggle, Virgil, Renee Rodriguez, Clinton Sparks, Baron Davis, Marshall Falk, Maria Diamond, Diane Cannon, 3,200 people. Just go to Ticketmasters. Get your tickets today, July 19th at YouTube Theater. Thank you for joining us. Remember, most importantly, be kind to your future self and do good deeds. We'll see you later.